So we chose our spouse and we got married and now we have a baby. What's next? Psalm 127 verse 3, children are an heritage of the Lord and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hands of a mighty man, so are the children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. Our children are treasures. Jesus loved them and we love them. But how do we treat these treasures? It's a sobering moment when for the first time you take your newborn baby into your arms and you look down into those little eyes which are looking back into yours. We want the best for our children and we want to raise righteous offspring. So what do we do? I have 4 points. Number one, take heed to yourself. You are your child's main role model. You must be what you want your children to be. If you want your children to be different than you are, you've got to become different than you are. A little girl said to her mother, "Mom, you're getting some white hairs." Her mother said, "Yes, and every time you disobey me, I get another white hair." Little girl thought about that for a moment and she said, "Mom, is that why Grandma has a full head of white hair?" Is my spiritual life in order? God will help you with that, but not against your will. You've got to lend yourself to the process of beneficial change. Maybe the hardest part of raising righteous offspring is being what you want them to become. On airplanes, they always tell us, if the oxygen mask drops, put yours on first and then help your child on with theirs. Why? Because if you pass out, you can't help your child. So take heed to yourself. The importance of example cannot be overstated. More is caught than taught. And you can't fool your child forever. You can fool them for a while when they're little. But they see you on good days and bad days, and your child will come to know what you really are. And someday, they may follow your example instead of your advice. Abraham lied about Sarah. So Isaac lied in almost the same words. In the next generation, Jacob lied too. We are born imitators. That's how we learn language, and that's how we learn behavior. David sins sexually, and then his son Amnon takes his sexual sin a step further. But Paul said, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Children are mirrors with legs, and they're more reliable mirrors than we might sometimes wish. Exhortation without example is hypocrisy. What you do speaks so loudly, they can hardly hear what you say. If I'm a hypocrite, I can expect my child to be. I must take heed to myself and give my heart to God. There are little eyes upon you, and they're watching night and day. There are little ears that quickly take in every word you say. There are little hands all eager to do everything you do, and a little boy that's dreaming of the day he'll be like you. Take heed to yourself. Number two, win the heart of your child. Proverbs 23:26, my son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. The children of God do the will of God from the heart, Ephesians 6, verse 6. The obedience of a Christian is not primarily from the prodding of peers or the pushing of parents or the pull of popularity or the praise of people. It's the result of a decision that I will do what God has called me to do because he's done so much for me and I love him and it's the right thing to do. Yes, there is a mixture of fear and love, but Psalm 110 says to Jesus, your people shall be willing, volunteers in the day of thy power. Our children can obey us in that way, but we need their earnest attention and their willing submission. I need my child's confidence, allegiance, and affection. Successful instruction cannot take place without the heart. Rules without relationships breed rebellion. Who wants to follow the advice of someone with whom they have no connection? If you have your child's heart, They listen and obey because they value the relationship they have with you. They value the fellowship with you. They don't want to disappoint you. They don't want to displease you. They don't want to compromise that relationship. So it's not only about trying to avoid punishment, though that is a factor, of course. But we have a relationship. We've laughed together. We've played together. We've rolled around on the floor together. And then when you tell them to do something they don't like, they don't want to displease you. If I don't have that relationship, then I can only get them to obey with my authority. And parenting with only authority only works for a while. But then they get older and they get bigger and they're not afraid of you anymore. I've got to have a relationship, and that takes time. And it takes focused attention. It takes eye contact. It takes physical contact. Don't use eye contact only when you're trying to make a negative point, although it can certainly work for that. Jesus looked at Peter after the denials, and Peter went out and cried like a baby. It can work for that, but eye contact means more than just that. I've got to get to the place where I have a relationship with my child, where eye contact can be done while we're laughing, and there's something that passes between us. Use eye contact as a continuous love-giving route, not merely as a means of discipline. Some of us touch our children only when necessary. It's such a simple thing to touch a child on the shoulder or gently poke them in the ribs. Babies need to be held and cuddled and hugged and kissed. And when does that stop? Girls need physical contact with their fathers all the way through adolescence. We need to convey our love to our children in multiple ways. We need to find time to spend time alone with each child, whether we have one child or 10. We must actively listen to our child. And then our child can obey us with a willing spirit rather than with a bitter, whiny, sullen spirit. The prophecy about John the Baptist at the end of Malachi is that he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers. But the father's hearts are turned first. We love because he first loved us. I need to actively love my child. Love is magnetic. If your child knows that you genuinely love them, then they want to be around you. Love draws people to it. If I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. So, are you a magnet or a repellent to your child? Time with your child needs to be a big priority. And children want that. The story is told of a boy who asked his dad, "Dad, how much do you make per hour?" And his father gruffly said, "Well, that's kind of personal." But he eventually told him, "I make $20 an hour." Boy said, "Dad, can I borrow $10? "What do you want to borrow $10 for?" "No, I don't think that's a good habit for you to be into." "No." But later the dad got to thinking maybe he'd been too harsh, so he went to the boy's room and he said, "Here, son, here's a $10 loan." And the boy gratefully grabbed the 10. He reached under his pillow and pulled out another 10. He held out both bills to his father and said, "Dad, can I buy an hour of your time?" It's a sacrifice worth making. "Suffer the little children to come unto you and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." The Christian life is about self-denial, and so is godly parenting. What was it that happened in the lives of David and Samuel and Hezekiah? Godly men. But look at their families. Look at their children. David's house fell apart. Samuel's sons were so awful to God's people that the people wanted a king rather than to be judged by them. And Hezekiah had Manasseh as a son. What happened? Were these fathers too busy with the Lord's work to raise their own sons? Time well spent with your children is an investment that can pay enormous dividends in the future for them and maybe for you too. Focused attention. That's our full, undivided attention. And it lets the child know that he is valuable enough in his own right to warrant his parents' watchfulness and appreciation. Focused attention is one of the most demanding needs that a child has. So turn your phone off. Mark 3:14 tells us that Jesus ordained 12 that they should be with him and that he might send them forth to preach. He ordained 12 apostles to send them forth to preach, but his first agenda with them was for them to just be with him. They spent years with him. So that when he was gone, we read in Acts 4:13 that when the Sanhedrin saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men, they marveled, but then they realized that they had been with Jesus. Being with Jesus had an effect. And you've got one shot at raising your child. One shot to help them know who God is and why they should serve and love him. It's worth the time because you can't get that time back. I know that while you're raising them, sometimes it just seems like it's going to go on forever. But when it's over, you very well may think, man, that went fast. Use the time well. Spend it throwing a baseball around the yard, playing with dolls, roughhousing with the boys on the floor, playing Candyland, playing hide and seek, telling jokes, talking about what's on their minds. This is the only way. No matter how many children you have, find time to spend with them individually. Maybe especially those neglected middle children. One by one is the best way to know somebody. Focus on the child, not the activity. You may hate Candyland. Somebody wants to play it, go ahead and play it and focus on the child. Enjoy the child, not just the activity. Listen to your child so you can know your child. Repeat the child's thoughts and feelings back to her to ensure that she understands, that you understand. Proverbs 22:6, a much discussed verse. Train up a child in the way he should go. Each child has his or her own bent. So train him up according to his personal characteristics. They're not all alike. One child is creative, another is practical. One is submissive, another is more aggressive. One is intelligent, another is not so bright. One is innovative, another is imitative. One is competitive, one is cooperative. One's a joiner, one's a loner. One is pugnacious, another is timid. Know the way your child is made. They're just not alike, even in the same family. Cain and Abel may have even been twins. They were different as night and day. Jacob and Esau were twins, different as night and day. Absalom and Solomon, same father, same court life, so different from each other. So we don't use the same approach with all of the children. And don't compare the children to each other. Judy, how come you can't be more like Debbie? That's devastating to a child. Don't try to fit them all into the same cast. The parent, by study and observation, discovers the child. Many children who rebel can remember a time when they began to see that their parents didn't understand them or were not trying to understand them. And the child turns within and develops a hatred of many things. Know your child and win their heart. No amount of training in the scriptural sense will be successful if we fail to know our children and appreciate their God-given capacities. Paul told the Philippians, you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. Philippians 2:12. The sweetest obedience is when I'm not even there, and they obey anyway. So take heed to yourself, win your child's heart. Number three, teach, train, and discipline. Teach, train, and discipline. These topics are close enough together that there is some overlap. Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Well, how would you provoke them to wrath? Well, through constant criticism or unfair comparisons or being a hypocrite or abusive words or physical abuse. Like Tom Petty said, there's so many ways to be wicked. So many ways to do this wrong, and basically one way to do it right. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. The father bears the primary responsibility to teach, train, and discipline in the home, and the mother works along with him. But the father is the head. If my body walks into a wall, I don't blame my feet. It's the head's fault. Fathers, you are the initiators in your homes. I know there are lots of demands on you. You're trying to be the breadwinner for the family. You have long hours. You're sent out of time to work. Where are you going to find the time? I don't know. That's for you to figure out. But figure it out you must if your goal is to raise righteous offspring. Who right now is doing the spiritual leading in your home? Who is saying the word "let's" most often? As in, let's pray together as a family. Let's be at church as regularly as possible. Let's be part of that Bible study. Let's study the Bible. Let's read the Bible together here at home. Sometimes it's the mother. And it's not that the father doesn't care. But maybe he doesn't care enough. Consider Jephthah in Judges chapter 11. Jephthah was an illegitimate child and was cast out. Just imagine what that does to a boy. He may have had an inferiority complex. He may have felt like he had something to prove. And opportunity came knocking. Israel has trouble with the Ammonites. They know Jephthah has the ability to lead men. We need someone to lead us against Ammon. Will you do it? So he strikes a deal with them. But Jephthah knows that to be successful, he needs the Lord's help. So what does he do? He tells God, if you will deliver Ammon into my hands, then whatever first comes out of my house when I get home shall be the Lord's. What was Jephthah thinking? Clearly, he didn't expect his daughter to be the first out of the door. An animal could easily have been the first. But there was no guarantee. Was Jephthah glad when his daughter came out? Oh, no. He was terribly grieved. He did not intentionally turn his back on his daughter. He probably wanted to be a good father, a better father than he had had. He loved his daughter, but he loved success more. And that's what prompted that rash and foolish vow. Raising children has to be a priority if I'm going to do it right. Beware of rash vows. Well, yes, I'll take that job away from home. It's only for a year. She's little now. She'll never miss me. It won't matter. I'll make it up later. We can let success, as defined by the world, allow the good things of life to rob us of the best things. And the child gets sacrificed on the altar of your success. Is that what happened with Samuel, Hezekiah, David? Godly men who were doing God's work. I think this can happen with any of us, with work or with activities we enjoy. And what does it profit if I gain the whole world and lose my children? Do you, Christian father, spend time in your home reading the Bible with your children? Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7. These words which I command thee these days shall be in thine heart. Got to be in your heart first. And then thou shalt teach them diligently unto your children when you sit, when you walk, when you lie down, when you rise up. Make teaching your children a part of the rhythm of life. Is the Word of God a topic of discussion in your home, at the dinner table, in the car, so that it doesn't seem weird to talk about it? Can we find just 5 or 10 minutes on a fairly regular basis to read the Bible together as a family? That says to the children, this is a priority. This is important. This matters. Extended family can reinforce this. I remember sitting under an elm tree on the farm, shelling peas or snapping beans, and my Aunt Mabel would suddenly say, I'm thinking of somebody in the Old Testament whose name starts with J. And it was up to me to guess, you know, Joshua, no, Jezebel, no, Jacob, no. I might guess 2 or 3 dozen people before I'd get it right. And then I'd say, I'm thinking of somebody that starts with an A. We could go on like that for hours, and guess what? We were never interrupted by a cell phone. God has not given to the church the responsibility of raising up righteous offspring. He gave that responsibility to the parents. The church will supplement, the church will confirm, the church can corroborate, but the church cannot undo what the parents do for years in the home. The church is not the main menu. The church may be the vitamins. But if you only eat vitamins and supplements, you'll die. You want to try that? No, I don't think you do. Teen studies won't do it. Bible classes won't do it. These are things intended by man. We have the liberty to use them. We do use them, and much good is done by them. I'm thankful for them. But God invented the family, and the home is the place where life makes up its mind. When we discipline our children, we are cultivating habits in them that should occur like automatic responses. The tree of knowledge of good and evil was a test. Adam and Eve had to make a choice. And it was the least intrusive kind of a test. They weren't asked to do something, just leave something undone. And God would respond based on their choice. We can do this with little children at 6 months. Your six-month-old is crawling across the floor and they reach out for a power cord. Going to grab a hold of that power cord. Well, I could pick the child up and take it somewhere else and evade the issue. I could move the cord so it's no longer a problem. But maybe it's time to use the word no. Just gently say no and gently swap that little hand. Gently, not harshly. The first time you do that, they just learn that there is a word no and that it is associated with pain. So maybe they reach toward the cord again. No, and a little harder flick of the hand. Nothing harsh, either in voice or in the swat. It's just training. It takes patience, but it's worth it. And consistency is enormous. Consistency is almost the whole ballgame here. They learn that they don't have to know why you're saying no. They get into the habit that when you say no, they stop just as an automatic response. And this is important because we want them to respond automatically to God and to us, whether they understand why or not. I've got a grandson here someplace. When he was, about 20 years ago, he was 3 years old. We were in Bolivar, Pennsylvania. John and I were teaching at their camp out, and that was at a community center where there was a large acreage there. There was a ball diamond, and there was a large meadow of green grass that had kind of a rise at the end of it. There was a road there, but you couldn't really see the road from where they were. I was tall enough I could see the tops of some cars going back and forth on this road. And one afternoon, several of us were walking across this grassy meadow toward this road. And Peter, you know, the kids have been sitting in church all morning, so they're ready to get out and move around. Peter energetically started running toward that road, only he probably didn't know there was a road there. He ran way out in front of us, and it was starting to get, I thought, a little perilous. So his father, John, with his big voice, said one word. Stop! That boy stopped in his tracks. I don't think he knew why he needed to stop. All he saw was grass stretching out in front of him. But he heard his father say stop, and he knew to stop, so he stopped. I don't say that that saved his life. I don't know if it did or not, but it might have. We need them to obey automatically whether they understand why or not. We can explain why later if appropriate. But an automatic response could save us from a tragedy someday. We want them to obey God whether they understand why or not. Children must learn that disobedience comes with consequences. The wages of sin is death. You represent God to your children. They need to respond to you, whom they can see, in a way that is readily and heartily given, so they can rightly respond to the authority of a God whom they cannot see. So cultivate a habit of obedience by automatic response. Consistency probably is the most important component of this training. If I let a child get away with it now, and then a little later I come down on him for the same offense, what did I just teach? I'm teaching that there's a chance that they might get away with it again. If it's important enough to have a rule about it in the first place, it's important enough to enforce that rule incessantly. Because if a child wants something and they know there's a 50-50 chance of discipline if they do it, well, mom doesn't always stop me even though she says no. Sometimes she lets me go three or four times before she gets irritated enough to stop me. If they know that, they're going to gamble. And they learn your patterns. So consistency, thou art a jewel. Every time, without harshness, every time this behavior receives this consequence, and that's how we learn. And foster first time obedience. If you know they heard you and they didn't obey, why mess around? Why go through this lengthy process? I hear parents lie to their children on a regular basis. If you do that again, I'm going to swat you. Kid does it again, no swat. That's a lie. Mean what you say or don't say it. Act promptly when disobedience is delayed. If children learn they can put you off, they will. All of your children will put you off continually if you allow that. All that does is exasperate you. Don't threaten with punishment that you won't carry out. And always win. Always win with your children. One time, one of my sons and I were in the bathroom, and I don't even remember. One of us wanted a drawer open, and the other one wanted it closed. I don't remember why or much about the details of it. But it turned into a battle of wills. So we stood there a while, and the punishments were becoming increasingly severe because he had to leave the drawer the way I wanted it. And I told him, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, but I have to win. And you do. You have to win those battles no matter how long it takes, and you have to win them every time. They have to learn that what you say goes because you represent God to them. But even in discipline, you've got to let them know that you love them. A spanking does not mean that I don't like you or that I don't love you. It's not a rejection of you. I'm rejecting your behavior. They need to understand that. And don't let guilt keep you from doing what you have to do. Well, how can I punish it in him when I did the same thing when I was young? Don't let guilt over your past keep you from doing the right thing in the present. I wonder if that's why David did not discipline Amnon. Amnon raped Tamar, and David didn't do a thing. Why? Did he just feel too guilty about it? David had been guilty of a sexual sin himself just recently. Is that why? I don't know why, but I do know that his family paid a heavy price. When you believe there has been an offense, but you didn't see it, when there has been a dispute among the children and you're not sure who's right, it can be very difficult, but when you think your child did something wrong and should be punished, be sure you first listen to your child so that you are operating on the basis of correct information. And at some point in a moderate moment, you might just want to ask your child, what things do I do that make it hard for you to obey me? And just see what they say. They may say, well, it's when you haven't listened to me and therefore don't understand what has happened. That makes it harder to obey you. Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit. God knew that. But God still encouraged them to talk. He let them offer all their excuses. Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent. And the serpent didn't have a leg to stand on. And then God made his pronouncement. He gave his sentence. He showed by this process that he was justified in his actions. Nobody could accuse him of not listening. They knew God heard us and our excuses were found lame. So hear your children out and then make your ruling. It's easier for them to accept that punishment because they feel like they're dealing with a fairer authority and they know you understand, and that makes a big difference, especially to some children. Did you ever punish a child and you thought it was obvious why? And then you found out later that they didn't even know why they'd been punished. With a small child, you might want to ask them if they understand why you're going to spank them. We're trying to cultivate hearts that are receptive to the gospel. So take heed to yourself, win your child's heart, teach, train, and discipline. And finally, number four and last, guard them from influences that could damage or callous them. Very important. Whoever wrote this assignment mentioned the book, The Anxious Generation, by Jonathan Haidt. I very much appreciate you mentioning that to me because I probably would not have read it otherwise, and I'm glad that I did read it. Jonathan Haidt is a self-proclaimed atheist and is constantly talking about how we evolved to be the way we are. But he does have a lot of meaningful things to say about children and cell phones. There's a lot there worth considering. I know very little about this personally. This kind of reminds me, this part of the assignment of 20 years ago, I was teaching a class at the two-week meeting at the Gregory Boulevard Church, 2005, and the class started asking me a bunch of questions about Zanga. Anybody remember Zanga? I never did figure out exactly what it was, but I talked about it without knowing anything about it, and this reminds me, this is similar to that. Jonathan Haidt talks about how phones are interfering with children's social and neurological development, covering everything from sleep deprivation to attention fragmentation, addiction, loneliness, social comparison, perfectionism, and the list goes on. He explains why social media damages girls more than boys and why boys have been withdrawing from the real world into the virtual world. The burden of the book is that our phones are damaging us and our children. He talks about the switch from a play-based childhood that I had to a phone-based childhood. You know, when I was a boy, I could spend a lot of time and did spend a lot of time just out in the pastures and ponds and woods by myself. But today, if a young person goes out there and they have their phone with them, all of their friends are there and potentially the whole world is there with them. It interested me when Haidt said, now I'm an atheist, but I want to ask, does the phone-based life generally pull us upward or downward? If it's downward, then there is a spiritual harm, he says, for adults as well as adolescents. He talks about keeping up spiritual practices involving well-being and reducing self-focus and selfishness. He talks about congregations like we have here today singing together, which opens their hearts to each other and to God, a God he doesn't believe in, I guess, but he talks about it. He talks about what goes on in church meetings and the enhanced feelings of communion and trust, which makes a group of individuals feel as though they are one. He talks about the value of kneeling together, standing together, singing together, and eating together, stuff we do. So I haven't allowed myself time to talk about this book, but if you're concerned about phones, you might want to look at it. And if you're not concerned about phones, maybe you should look at it or at least consider the concepts in it. I'm sure it's available at libraries and maybe online for free. I read a hard copy and I'm glad I did. So thanks for mentioning it. The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. I'll just in conclusion say this. Keep out of your child's life anything that would keep Christ out of her heart. Proverbs 4:23, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. You and I are like computers, garbage in, garbage out. The way I respond to things is a product of what I have allowed to come in. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. They're not able to protect their own heart. They are born somewhat blank slates, and the world is all too ready to write in the book of your child's heart. Even some people who mean well can be problematic. But there are millions of ready writers for your child's heart. And not everyone has a right to write on the heart of your child. Guard your children's hearts so they can be receptive to the Lord. Parent and child are bound together by a rope called responsibility. When you're little, I give you about that much rope, and I hold on to it tight. As you grow older, I give you more rope. As you take more responsibility, I give you more rope. And the goal is to get to the place where I can let go of the rope and you thrive as a flourishing Christian adult. Right now, I think we have one of the finest groups of young people that we have ever had. We have a new group every 4 or 5 years, but if this group we've got right now is not one of the best, they've got me fooled. And to me, that says that a lot of parents are doing a lot of things right. So I encourage you to keep up the good work, and I encourage all of us to do better than we're doing.